You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast.
Hello and welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Damian Francis. This week, Mumbrella founder and editor-at-large Tim Burrows speaks to one of the most notable names in the Australian media and marketing industry, Simon Reynolds. Yes, that's Simon with two eyes, and yes, he was the mastermind of the famous Grim Reaper campaign. Don't know it? Search for it on YouTube. It is a must-see. After more than a decade away, he's back in the industry. Tim finds out why, and a lot more, right now.
Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Most people who leave Australia's advertising industry are quickly forgotten, but not Simon Reynolds. It's about 14 years since he stepped away, but he's still talked about, and now he's returned to the marketing world as chair of social e-commerce platform Buyer's Circle. Now, Simon, welcome back. We will talk about what you've been up to since leaving Adland, but let's start with your latest role. What is Buyer's Circle?
Well, Buyer's Circle is an absolutely fascinating company based on a company in China, Pinduoduo, which frankly I had never heard of until the guys from Buyer's Circle came to talk with me. But Pinduoduo is amazing. It's only 5 years old and it's already bigger, has more monthly users than Alibaba. So it gets 720 million monthly users. And Buyer's Circle is an Australian version of that. So what does it do? Well, it uses something called social selling. So most selling sold from websites. And with Buyer's Circle, what happens is it's sold through connections on social media. So you don't need to set up a website. If you're an e-tailer, you just grab hold of this stuff and send it through social media. Now, up till now, it's been the Chinese-Australian community. So incredibly, there's already 687,000 users of it, of Buyer's Circle, and it's expanding into the Caucasian market in Australia and beyond.
And how did it come about that you became involved? Because clearly, this is significant involvement. You're chairman of the board, which means that if not a full-time job, you're certainly all in driving the success of the business. So how did it happen? And I presume you're not short of offers. So what was it about this one that decided this is the one for you to get involved in?
Well, I'm non-executive, so I'm not full-time. And I have been, what a lot of people don't know, is I have been and still are a director of a Melbourne ad agency called DPR, which is also non-executive. So I help those guys out, incredible agency, doing extremely well. And as it so happens, I know quite a few people in the capital raising area of Australia. So, you know, for a long time, I've been involved in capital raisings, private companies, public companies, and stuff. And so I knew a couple of the VCs, and they approached me and said, look, we've been funding this company or investing in this company, Buyer's Circle. It's growing really fast, and it probably needs a chairman to potentially package it succinctly to the market, to the public, and who understands marketing, but who also understands public companies, which Buyer's Circle will one day be.
Yeah, I was going to ask, actually, do you see a route to the ASX or one of the other markets?
Yeah, I think so. We are just completing a 5 million round of raising, and then probably before the end of the year, we'll raise again. And then maybe at the end of next year, we might list. But, you know, it's so hard to tell the way the markets are at the moment. You know, who knows what date it will be, but it's in the future of the company. It's definitely an intention.
So speaking of listed companies, you certainly, in terms of visibility, you left the industry in November 2007 when you resigned as a director of Photon Group, which is known as an aero these days. That was still flying high on the ASX at that point. Certainly looking back at the reporting of your exit at the time, the word surprise was used. What made you step away? Were you stepping away from the advertising world, or were you stepping towards something else? What was going on for you at the time?
Yeah, great question. Well, that was the height of the stock market at the time, and I think Photon was valued at $500 million at the time, and I was getting moving further and further away from the company. You know, they had it was driven by this guy Tim Hughes, and who was really a money market guy. He was Reg Grundy's primary money manager, or one of the two money managers, and it was becoming a long way away from advertising. You know, I started out as a copywriter, and this was a company with 54 companies in 14 countries, and it really wasn't my kind of gig after a while, and like yourself, I'd spent my life working hard, and I just wanted a break. So I took a year off to write a book, and then the stock market crash happened. You know, it's I got out at the right time, but then Photon suffered, pretty fiercely. But what's really interesting is in its current incarnation and era, I mean, that's still worth over $200 million on the stock market. You know, it's still a strong marketing services group, but since then, I wouldn't even know who's on the board. I mean, I'm completely disconnected.
Yeah, look, it must have been a strange experience, sort of, yeah, watching this thing that you'd helped build, you know, come out the other side of the GFC. So you'd at least been wise enough to exit your investment as well, had you, by that point?
Well, certainly a lot of it, not all of it, a lot of it. And, you know, it was such a bizarre time at that point because, people forget, but people were questioning whether Australian banks would survive. That's how fierce that the GFC was in our country, and it was a good time to be out of it. I can tell you, I wouldn't have been wanted to be in any of those meetings.
And we seem to be having a sort of almost like a second wave of local holding companies, or certainly the ambitions for them. You know, we saw the growth ops sort of roll up a little while back. We've now got Cam Murchison out of New Zealand with Ativo. You've got Ben Lilly doing it with McCann. You've got Simon Ryan trying to do it with Ryancap. Do you think inherently that sort of service company model works? Could it happen again, do you think?
Well, I think it could certainly happen again, but in order to make those kind of companies go, you've really got to have deep connections with investors. So the thing about Tim Hughes was he really knew the investors. I mean, if you look at now, Jeff Wilson, David Paradise, the superstars of the Australian investment world, they rented space in Tim's office floor. You know, like everybody was so close. And so his ability to raise capital was absolutely incredible. I don't know these other companies, how good their ability to raise capital is, but that's half the job, is just continuously raising. We'd raised hundreds of millions of dollars to buy companies. So that's one part of it. And then the other part of those groups that people have got to be careful to watch is they promise synergies. They promise all these cost savings, and we're going to send our clients over to this company, and they're going to give them, we'll all profit from each other. And I think that's hard to pull off. People don't want to send their clients over to the other company that the holding company's got. They don't particularly want to interact that much with those other companies. So it's a difficult thing to pull off and get any advantage beyond the actual companies as individual companies. And, you know, if this was a finance and investing podcast, we could go deep into that. But, you know, we'll leave it at the fact that it's a challenge, I guess.
Well, you invest a bit yourself as well, I know. Do you have a thesis for what you look for when you invest in something?
Well, I'd love to, you're very kind to say that, whether I'm intelligent enough to have a thesis about investing. I can say going forward, I think it's going to be hard to lose your money investing in a group of SaaS companies. I think the tectonic shift that's occurring, as I'm sure you know, is the rise of software as a service. And so really to jump on that boat, to take a diversified position with a lot of SaaS companies, I think in the next 5 years is going to be a pretty safe bet. You know, got to pick the right ones, of course. But look, to me, everybody talks about the changing nature of industries, et cetera, but it really comes down to this. Are you one of the first in a market? Do you have people that are really leaders that work hard and can drive a company forward? And I think as long as you're doing those two things, you've got a really good chance of having a growing company and a company worth investing in.
And at what stage do you usually invest? What stage of the company?
Yeah, normally they've got some revenue. So they might have a million in revenue, 2 million in revenue, and they're growing fast with a clear point of difference.
Now, changing the subject to the creative side of your working life, because I suppose that's one of the interesting things about you is the fact that you have both a creative mind and a business brain. So you and I'm sure you won't go an interview without having it pointed out that you were involved in one of the most famous public health campaigns of all time, the Grim Reaper, which was warning about the dangers of HIV and AIDS. Now, as we're recording this, Australia is really facing a real problem around COVID vaccine hesitancy. If that was your brief, how would you think about the challenge?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think that it's crazy that they haven't gone hard on you've got to get the vaccine. You know, in the last 10 days, as of the time of recording, it's become apparent that it's a problem that people don't have vaccines. But if we go back 3 weeks, a lot of people, in fact, 30% of Australia, had no intention of getting the vaccine. Such was the feeling that we had nothing to worry about anymore. But I would definitely do, maybe not the Grim Reaper, but I would definitely do a hardcore version to wake people up that this thing could easily be around for another year. It could be around for another two. It could, you know, the different strains become more sophisticated, as we know, and become more dangerous. I think the problem is where the parallel is with the original AIDS campaign 30 years ago is no one knew anybody, or most people didn't know anybody who had AIDS. You know, certainly the heterosexual community didn't. It was either gays or it was IV drug users, largely in Australia, that got AIDS. But it's kind of similar here. Like, how many people actually know someone who's got COVID in Australia? Not many. And as a result of that, everybody's just not believing that it's going to be particularly a problem for them. Now, there's two things that an ad campaign's got to do, you know, speaking to someone who knows more about it than me, but it's got to inform and it's got to persuade. The problem is with the government advertising now, it's only informing, you know, it's only, you know, making statements about things. It's not tugging the heart in any way. It's not affecting us emotionally. It's not persuading, particularly in any way, other than just like you know, someone reading off an auto cue. It's just a very low level of marketing, in my opinion.
And what are the levers one should think about pulling with a campaign like this? Is it about self-interest, or is it about doing the right thing, or is there no actual right answer?
I don't have much faith in the doing the right thing. It's a bit like, you know, for the environment, we'll do a little bit, we'll put it in a different bin, you know, our rubbish in a different bin, but is the average person really going to do much? I'm not sure the average person is. To me, it's about two things. It's, first of all, letting people see how painful COVID is, and then getting people to talk about it who people actually want to listen to. So a classic example of a potential ad, in my view, is to get Pink to lead the campaign. So what a lot of people don't know is she almost died from COVID. So she's someone that anyone under 50, a lot of people under 50 are going to listen to. They're going to watch an ad with Pink talking to them. And she was in such pain that she rewrote her will for her children during the time she had COVID, because she thought she was going. Now, if you got a series of people that actually had it talk about how bad it is, then I think you could wake a lot of people up. Now, what a lot of people are saying is get celebrities. But celebrities isn't it. I mean, you know, every second Rolex ad has some celebrity holding a Rolex. And is anyone persuaded by that? I don't think so. But get celebrities who have been crushed by COVID, and then you got an ad campaign.
Speaking of the advertising world, you've been lucky enough to cross paths with some of the biggest names, certainly in Australian advertising history. You worked for John Singleton. You employed a young David Droga. You've crossed paths with the likes of Ted Horton and others. Which advertising practitioners do you admire?
Well, I mean, I have to be honest that most of the people I admire, I grew up admiring people in the UK ad industry. You know, I was in the 90s, that was just the hottest place on earth. And guys like Dave Trott from Gold Green, Les Trott, or David Abbott, or, you know, these Ligas Delaney, Tim Delaney, these were people that, you know, I wouldn't say worship, but not far off. I mean, I can literally repeat end lines that they wrote from 30 years ago because they're so embedded. I studied those ads so deeply. And so they're the people that I really most admired. But of the people you mentioned, you know, they're fascinating characters. Dave, you know, we hired him as a junior writer. He had a few months out. He topped award school. He had a few months out. He's a tremendous guy. He's a really good person. I have a lot of time for him. And what's fascinating about Dave is that usually when a junior writer starts, they're bad. And there's fragments of good in them that gets them the job. What was so amazing about Dave is that even 6 months into the industry, he was excellent. He wasn't perfect, but he was excellent. And that was very unusual. And then, of course, he had the work ethic that goes with it, you know. So much of Australian advertising up to the point when we started Oman and you know, a couple of other agencies at the same time was about coming up with a good idea. And the switch which guys like David Droga embodied, and certainly our agency embodied at the time, was to come up with a lot of ideas and then pick the very best rather than go to lunch. Very much the UK work ethic, you know, the Tim Delaney work all day, work all night type of work ethic. So Dave matched his talent with work. Ted Horton, an incredible guy, because there used to be two schools of advertising. I don't know if it's still the case, but there was those who could write award-winning ads and then those who said they didn't work but probably couldn't write them in the majority of cases. Teddy is almost unique in that he was absolutely one of the best creative writers and then turned to doing styles that were the opposite of that, but still very good. And he did it with the client in mind. You know, he said, well, okay, what's best for the client? Maybe I shouldn't do this clever ad. Maybe I should do an ad that's more strategically sound. And he's quite unique in my view that of being able to do both styles very, very well. And then Singo is probably the brightest guy I've met in advertising, and just absolutely fascinating guy. My experience of him is a very decent person. He was always honourable to me. I sold my agency to Singo, one of my agencies to Singo, and he was absolutely fascinating. And people in the industry might find this interesting. When we outside Singleton's, when it was the absolute juggernaut of new business, people always assumed, well, they must have such a sophisticated new business machine. I always thought that. And when I finally went in there, because I was on a two-year deal, I walked in there and there was no new business machine at all. It was just the cult of personality that Singo, everybody just wanted to give him work. And he knew everybody from the richest in Australia, very good friends with Kerry Packer, very good friends, and James and everybody else. He just knew everybody. And everybody wanted to work with him. And that was how he grew the business.
Somebody who I was researching, I think you might be able to guess, said I should ask you this question. Who is the Marvel?
It's Teddy. It's Ted Horton. So this stemmed from when I was a junior writer and George Betches, a great friend of mine, we were both junior writers. And Ted was, of course, the kind of senior writer. And he'd come around to the agency and he'd say, I'm a Marvel and you guys are the junior Marvels. You know, one day you'll be a Marvel like me, you know, all tongue in cheek. But 30 years later, we still call him the Marvel, and he is the Marvel, and he rightfully takes that throne.
Well, I'm hoping we'll have Ted on the Umbrella cast before too long as well. Now, you spend a fair bit of your time now as a sort of mentor of business people and entrepreneurs. How do you approach that?
Yeah, interesting question. I do a lot of mentoring. So I mentor when they want it, the guys from DPR, the Melbourne agency, which is doing so well. I mentor startup entrepreneurs, and I also mentor larger entrepreneurs, you know, as big as turning over a billion a year, Aussie entrepreneurs. And it's absolutely fascinating because it's intimate. You know, I do everything on Zoom, but for one client, I do it all on Zoom and have done for 12 years. But you get to really know these people really closely. You know, they level with you what's happening in their company and the problems they're happening and happening. And we deal in two things. The first is how to grow the company faster, but the second is for themselves. You know, to reduce stress. A lot of them under huge stress, or to use their time better, or just to, you know, be reflective of their life, because as you know you've built a premier media company, you're just incredibly endlessly doing tasks. You could easily work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and not complete your to-do list as an entrepreneur of a fast-growing company. So it becomes very rare to reflect on your performance, and that's part of what I do as a mentor.
And do you help them in sort of setting the goals and then helping hold them to account? You know, is it one of those things they're sort of thinking, oh, I've got my catch up with Simon tomorrow, I better get this done?
Absolutely. Yeah, there is no doubt that half the homework we do is done the day before that they've got to meet with me. And I don't think there's anyone, certainly myself included, but I don't think there's anyone that doesn't get better with coaching. You know, you look at guys like the chairman of Google until recently, he had a coach. Steve Jobs had a coach. You know, the head of Ford, Alan Mulally, had a coach. Obama had a leadership coach, Marshall Goldsmith. You know, people at the top, it doesn't matter how good they are, you get better by being held accountable, as you said. And we all rise when we have to answer to someone, and someone holds a mirror to us as well. And, you know, as Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. And, you know, while I wouldn't go that far, it's certainly a lower level of life. And so I'm a huge believer in mentors in every category of life.
And something you mentioned earlier when you stepped away from Photon, one of the things you did in the time shortly afterwards was writing a book. And I know you've written a few. What is it that attracts you to the discipline, if it is the discipline, of writing books?
Well, I kind of began to move away from being a copywriter. You know, I would rarely write ads. And so I like writing, and I like writing about one subject, which is stuff that interests me. And what interests me most is personal development, human development. What's the ability for someone to become greater than they were? And, you know, that's for me often really sobering. Am I the person I should be? Am I the person I could be? And it's just a fascination for me how some people start with nothing and end up having achieved great things. And I'm not just talking materially, as characters, they might become amazingly strong and beautiful characters, or yes, they might make money, or they might have a skill set that might be, you know, succinct, like playing the cello or something. But greatness, human greatness, is just an amazingly fascinating subject for me. And to write about that is great, because you get to be the researcher, and then you just basically write about stuff that you learned. And so I only ever write about one subject, which is how to be better.
And I suppose something I found myself thinking about now, and we're going to have this conversation, was, as I've alluded to, the fact that you've got both the business brain and the creative brain. It seems like such a waste not having you running your own agency. Are those days definitely behind you, or have you got one more in you, do you think?
Well, you know, it's always possible. You know, anyone's got any offers, send them. Look, I tell you what I find just bizarre about advertising, and certainly Australian advertising, is, you know, I'm in my 50s and I hear, I'm okay because I just opened my own agencies, right? But I hear so many stories about really good people hitting 50 and people not wanting to employ them. And apart from the ethics of that, I just think it's so dumb because, you know, people in their 50s have got so much wisdom. And they've got experience, and just their playbook is so strong on how to solve problems, and they're also not dicks. You know, a lot of people, maybe even myself, you know, when we're young and we're arrogant and we haven't been hammered a million times by the fickle fate of failure, you know, they've got a kind of level of confidence stroke overconfidence, and which is great. But the thing about someone in their 50s is they're often really good characters all around. Not always, but good characters all around. And they should be running agencies. They should be opening their own agencies. And I think a lot of them are spooked by the fact that they're not valued as much as they should be. I think it's crazy. Look at David Abbott as an example. In his last year in England, Abbott Mead Vickers, which by then had become the number one sized agency in England and the number one award-winning agency. Now, I don't know how many people have ever achieved that. Number one in both categories. He was age 60 and he still won the Gold One show that year for best ad and then retired. And look, if the guy can do it at 60, he could have done it at 70. But in so many people are being written off just because they're 50. I think it's crazy.
And just to follow up something you said, I'm not sure if you were just joking or not when you said give you a call. Are you serious? Is there an offer that could come out to you that might persuade you to run another agency?
Well, here's the thing. I'm a big fan of the economist John Kay, who wrote a book called Obliquity. And obliquity is all based on the fact that people usually end up getting somewhere by a method they didn't expect. And he's got the incredible case studies of companies that were intending to do something and they ended up doing something else, right? So the most important thing, I think, is to be open to anything at all. So, you know, if someone said, I want to open a candy store, I'd listen to it. Because, you know, who knows whether that's going to take me to someplace extraordinary. So I'm definitely open to anybody saying they want to open an ad agency. But I will say this, it's not something I'm thinking about.
You mentioned you're in your 50s. You look a lot younger. You obviously look after yourself. Do you live a disciplined lifestyle?
Well, I used not to, but then I got married and got kids. So it's basically feed them and go to bed. You know, it's exhaustion is my main driver of my lifestyle. I do a bit of exercise. I do a lot of stress reduction. So I use a technique. There's a great book called The Sedona Method, which is a kind of 40-year-old method of reducing stress, which I do a lot, which is just basically during the day, just release the stress that's building up rather than wait for weeks and then have a massage every 3 months or whatever in the hope of reducing it. So I reduce stress a lot. I work on my mind a lot. One of my passions is elite mental sports psychology. So, you know, I study, they're mostly Americans. You know, who are the people that are inside LeBron James's head, keeping him in great mental condition, or, you know, the Utah Jazz or you know, any of these great sporting institutions in America, a lot of them have got mind coaches. And so it's a bit of a hobby of mine to try and learn the techniques of those people, because people will say, well, what's that got to do with, say, being in advertising or whatever? Well, a lot. You know, if we're under stress all the time and we still have to perform, just like they're under stress all the time and they really have to perform. So I do a lot of stuff, a bit of exercise, but a lot of stuff with the mind. And I think, long way of answering your question, I think that keeps me healthier than the average.
Now, people who know you do talk about the fact that you always have a positive outlook and that you don't seem to experience self-doubt. Is that where that comes from? Is it these techniques?
Well, first of all, I am often doubting myself and often not having the self-confidence that I think we all should have. You know, there's a great saying of the Canadian business coach, Dan Sullivan. He says, never compare your backstage to someone else's front stage. So my front stage may look to some people like, you know, it's everything's great. And I don't want to say that life isn't really good. But I fall down all the time, doubting myself compared to what I think I should, or not being the person that I think I should be. But I do agree with you that learning these techniques of, you know, mental performance is enormously helpful. And I work on it every day. I probably spend 20, 30 minutes a day making sure my mind's in good shape. I think that confidence, if you look at, you know, a lot of the studies on elite sports people, confidence is fastest variable. So if they want to get an athlete to perform better, they increase their confidence. That will do it more than anything else. And I think it's absolutely crazy that in business, in marketing services, you know, here we are running companies, but we're not keeping ourselves mind fit, even though we need confidence as much as any elite baseballer. We need persistence as much as any sportsman. We need optimism as much as any Navy SEAL, and they work on all these mental techniques as well. And I think I always like to ask myself this: in 50 years' time, what are people in our field going to be doing? And I think in 50 years' time, they're going to be working on their mind as much as they're working on their business, because the two are really correlated.
You have had your setbacks as well, and I know one that you've talked about in the past, and I guess it was famous at the time, was losing your job as creative director at a very young age. It was many years before certainly I came to Australia, but as far as I can tell, it was an enduring mystery. To this day, have you ever been able to get to the bottom of why you lost that job?
No, absolutely not. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't deserve to get sacked, because for people who are, you know, not 510 like myself, basically I became a creative director at 21. And it was in all the news, it was on A Current Affair, it was in BRW as the, you know, as top, you know, 20 moves of the in Australian business. It was a big deal. And while I was there, I did the AIDS ad, et cetera, et cetera. And I got sacked about a year and a half later. And the guy, the managing director, Gary Murphy, rang me. I was actually judging the TV awards, and he didn't even do it in person. He said, I don't think it's working out. I don't think you should come back to the agency. And, you know, if I was an adult, if I had been in the industry a bit longer, I would have kind of taken him up on this and been more confronting. But, you know, I didn't know what to do. Yeah, to this day, I don't know why I was sacked. We only did three business pitches. We won two. We went from nowhere in the awards to somewhere in the awards. I don't know. I don't know what it was. And unfortunately, he died 2 years ago, because I went to LinkedIn to look him up. And really just to say two things. First of all, thank you for giving me the chance, because, you know, it's 30 years later. I don't feel any kind of malice towards him. But also to say, hey, can you just tell me? I'm totally cool about it. But why did you sack me? But unfortunately, he's left the world.
Well, looking forward, obviously, we talked about the buyer's circle. What else is exciting you?
You know what? I'm mentoring quite a few people, and in some cases, I've got stakes in the company, and In the advertising world, what DPR is doing, I'm really excited. You know, they're phenomenal, what they're doing. I'm doing a lot of stuff in agricultural biotech at the moment. Working closely with a company called VRM Biologic, which is very big in China, but not yet big in the West. So I'm, you know, definitely with the tech feel, but not kind of classic tech, more kind of weird stuff that not everybody's looking at.
Well, Simon, thank you very much for your time.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Tim. It's an honor to meet you after all you've achieved.
That was Simon Reynolds, Chair of social e-commerce platform Buyer's Circle, speaking to Mumbrella founder and editor-at-large, Tim Burrows. Don't forget to listen out on Thursday for the next Mumbrella Cast, with latest news and reporter Xander Wilson speaking to the Bragg's Luke Gerges. I'm Damian Francis. Thanks for listening.